Hi there, John Telich here, and thank you very much for checking out this week's edition of Telich Talks. We are going to focus today on one of the greatest players in not just NFL history, but in the history of the short-lived All-American Football Conference. Marion Motley, Canton McKinley High School, Cleveland Browns in the AAFC, and then the Cleveland Browns when they joined the National Football League in 1950. He was also a trailblazer, one of four men in modern times to break the color barrier, along with his teammate Bill Willis and two others, coming into the pro football ranks in 1946. David Lee Morgan wrote a book about LeBron James. David Lee Morgan covered LeBron James in like the sixth and seventh grade when he was a burgeoning basketball talent and obviously would go on to be one of the greatest players in the history of the game. He was also a podcast guest here 1 year ago talking about LeBron James when James went past Kareem Abdul-Jabbar as the greatest scorer in NBA history. But this time we're talking about Marion Motley and the book that he penned about Mr. Motley. It's up for awards. It's a fascinating read. And I hope we can gain some insight into the strength of what Mr. Marion Motley brought, not just to pro football, but to sports in general. So I hope you enjoy our chat. This is David Lee Morgan talking about the great Marion Motley. Welcome to David Lee Morgan, several times an author, and your most recent work, the work on Marion Motley, I think more people need to know about it. How did that project get started for you?
You know, JT, first of all, thanks for having me, my man. You know, we've been working together, not together, but we've just been in the same circles forever. So I really appreciate you and everything you've done. And
likewise.
Yeah, it's you hit it on the head, JT. This Marion Motley story, it's just a story. The book came out in August, so it's only been out 7 months. Okay. But it's just, you're right. It's slowly taking this time to kind of germinate. It's an organic story, grassroots story that people are starting to kind of like sink their teeth into. And then once they do, they realize, wow, this is a really good story. And so it all started here in Canton with some friends of mine who were filmmakers who were a little bit younger than me, basically the same age, but maybe 3 or 4 years younger than me. But they went to Canton McKinley and they've got experience making films, but they always wanted to do a story on Marion Motley because they are Canton McKinley grads. And they always felt like Marion Motley's story, if you come down to Canton, you see there's a big banner. There's a mural downtown Canton that has four football players. And everybody will say, hey, you want to meet down where those old black football players are? And really, that was the only thing that a lot of people knew. They just knew that there's a mural of these old black football players. But those guys told such a rich history about the evolution of football as it related to black players. And so these guys said, hey, we want to do something to kind of commemorate or memorialize Marion Motley. Let's raise some money to put together a sign or something. Sure. Because outside of the bust in the Hall of Fame, really there was no other place you were going to see Marion Motley. So we ended up, doing more than that. We ended up doing a documentary that aired on PBS Western Reserve, and we won an Emmy for it, a regional Emmy for it, for best historical documentary. From that point on, we had so much material left. And I asked those guys if I could, continue to use some of that research that we used or that we did. And so I ended up writing a book, a more detailed story about Marion Motley and his just incredible story. And that's how the book came about. And had it not been for my friends who brought me aboard on that documentary, this would have never happened. So I'm very grateful for those guys for allowing me to be part of that project.
Well, I'll tell you, it's fascinating the ebbs and the flows of this man's life. Like Jim Brown, hails from Georgia,
and then finds his way up here in Canton, and like Jim Brown, has Paul Brown in his life. Take us back to that and how he helped, along with another Pro Football Hall of Famer, be the first two in the modern era black football players in the league.
Yeah, that's a good point, because Paul Brown is kind of, you know, connected to both of those guys, obviously. Yeah. More so with Paul Brown and Marion Motley, because Marion Motley, you know, once his family came here from Leesburg, Georgia to Canton, Marion Motley played for Canton McKinley, obviously, and Paul Brown was the coach at Maslin. So they faced each other. This is a great story that's in the book. Marion Motley, so Canton McKinley, you know, back then, John, and you probably know this just from your history, not because you're that old, but, you know, back then, if you were a freshman, you didn't play varsity, you know. So, you know, you didn't play varsity until you were in the 10th grade. So for Marion Motley and Camp McKinley, they were 25-3 his 3 years at McKinley. His only three losses were to Paul Brown at Maslin. Yeah, yeah. So that was an interesting connection. But what happened was, Marion Motley really wasn't he wasn't recruited at all, because, you know, he was a black player. And then, you know, Jim Crow laws and segregation and all of that, you know, those colleges weren't really recruiting black players a lot, especially Southern schools. So he went to South Carolina State for a short period, but didn't like it. It was the South. So he ended up going out to Nevada, where he played 3 years, and he had an incredible career out there. And that's where he made a name for himself. But after he finished at Nevada, this was like 1942, and it was time to go to the, you know, we were in the war. We were in World War II. So Paul Brown leaves Ohio State, and he gets commissioned into the service. So he is stationed as an officer at the Great Lakes Naval Training Facility in Chicago. And his job was to start a football team to build up morale and all of that. Well, Marion Motley leaves Nevada, goes back to Akron, and realizes he's going to have to enlist. So he goes to Cleveland and he enlists, and he tells the story in the documentary and in the book. He's in Cleveland and there's a line of people, guys signing up. And he said, there's an officer there. And the officer says, okay, as you move up, you go Army or Navy. And if it's Army, you go that way. If it's Navy, you go that way. Well, Marion said, I'm not sure what I was going to do, but he said, I heard the Navy had the better food. So, he gets there and they go, Navy. So he goes to the Navy. And guess where he's shipped out to? He's shipped out to the Great Lakes Naval Training facility in Chicago. And so now he's reconnected with Paul Brown in such, it's just almost like fate. And this is a great story. So what happens is, he goes through boot camp training, you know, boot camp, and they're about to ship those guys out to camp. Marion Motley finds out that Paul Brown is the football coach there. He didn't know. So he gets on the phone and he calls Paul Brown, and Paul Brown tells him, stay right where you are. Do not get on that train. And about 5 minutes later, Marion Motley said, there was a commandant on the phone that said, hey, are you Motley? He said, get your bags. He said, you're not going anywhere. You're staying here. And he ended up staying there and playing for Paul Brown. So that's how he got reconnected. Because had he not made that call, had Paul Brown not been at the Naval Training Facility, Marion Motley probably would have been dispatched off to war, and we probably would have never heard of Marion Motley.
That's absolutely is insane. And especially when you go back to, you know, facing him three times in high school, Maslin winning all three, McKinley doesn't even get a W in those three encounters. And then Marion Motley going to an HBCU, that didn't work out for him.
Yeah.
And Nevada of all places, any reason as to why Nevada, not some, you know, like Jackie Robinson was at a Southern Cal school, you know, why something else didn't prevail for him?
That's a great question, JT. And there's another Northeast Ohio connection. So what happened was, there was this football coach at Camp McKinley a few years before Marion. I think when Marion maybe was in seventh grade, there was a coach at McKinley. His name was Jim Aiken. And Jamaican was, he was at McKinley before Mary Motley came, but then he went to the University of Akron and he coached there. And he did
Got
so
it.
well there, he ended up going out to Nevada. So he
Okay.
became the head coach at Nevada in Reno. And once Aiken found out that Marion Motley had left South Carolina and went back home to Akron, he sent a ticket for Marion Motley to come out and play for him out in Nevada. So that was another a Northeast Ohio connection that really helped put Marion Motley back in college, because had it not been for Jim Aiken and that connection, Marion Motley would have been back at home here in Canton, probably working in the steel mill, because his family came up to work in the mills. So it's all relationships, and it was all just almost fate in almost every step that helped move him to the next level.
Very cool. It's his life trajectory is very, very fascinating. And obviously the Canton element, it is just paramount to what would become one of the greatest forces at his position in not just AAFC, but NFL history. This guy averaged 5.7 yards a carry. David, this is insane.
Yeah, yeah. You know, one of the things that was really interesting, because I had known about Mary Motley, you know, heard of him and covering the Browns and all of that when I was working for the Beacon Journal. You know of Mary Motley, but to see some of the film that we had and the guys who did the research for us on our team, Eric Lockery, he did a great job of getting these old films, and you see how big he was. Just, I think he was like 6'3", 250, 260, something like that, 245, 250. But he was so speedy. He was so fast. And, you know, a running back with that type of speed, with that size, it just made him so just incredibly hard to bring down. And that's what was so amazing about him and why he was able to average 5.7 yards a carry. He was fast. He was hard to bring down. And he was just, you know, just that mix together just made him so incredible.
Well, they were very turbulent yet moving along times in the late 40s, with he and Bill coming to the Cleveland Browns and being, as you alluded to, the reason why those four pictures of these old NFL football players, these black men, are on these banners, because he, you know, helped forge the way there. And then, of course, you know, Jackie Robinson in 47, and then the year, a month or two later, Larry Doby up in Cleveland.
Yeah.
Really amazing times post-war, and so many of them. Larry Doby served in served in the country.
Right.
For the armed services. So many of them connected to the military, too. Kind of weird.
Yeah, yeah. You know what, JT? What's interesting is, if you look at, you know, Jackie Robinson, obviously his story is amazing, opened the doors for so many people. Yeah. But it's an interesting story, because in 1946, when the Browns, Cleveland Browns, started in the AAFC, and Mary Motley and all the other three players broke the color barrier in professional sports. There's an interesting story, because Branch Rickey at the time, he was the president of the Los Angeles Dodgers. Or the Brooklyn Dodgers turned LA Dodgers. And they moved out. Yeah. And the thing was, he was from Ohio, and he was a big fan of the Cleveland Browns and Marion Motley. So he watched what was going on in 46 with the Cleveland Browns, and he studied that. And he realized that if Marion Motley and Bill Willis could do it in a brutal sport like football, you know, he felt like it was the right time to do that in baseball with Jackie Robinson. And, you know, when we talk to a lot of people for our film, and even with the book, a lot of people that we talk to in the Hall of Fame, friends of Jackie Robinson, Dave Robinson from the Green Bay Packers. You know, a lot of those guys talked about how, had it not been for 46, you know, 47 may not have happened when it did. And actually, you can think about this a little bit down the road, JT. So if you think about, if 46 didn't happen, who's to say when that color barrier in pro sports would have happened? It could have happened And it may not have happened until the civil rights movement in the 60s, because those owners were not obligated to sign anybody. You know, they made a pact from 1934 to 1946 to not sign any black players until Paul Brown came along. And so, you know, it's, you have to really think about, you know, what would have happened had that not happened. I mean, would it have been in the 50s? Would it have been 60, 65, 68 when we had a lot of those riots? And you think about the Washington Redskins, the, you know, Commanders now. I mean, the Washington team, they didn't sign their first black player until 1962. So there's no telling when that would have happened. So 46 really was an important time for all of sports. And, you know, what Paul Brown did, you know, was really got things going into 47. So I think 46 really was that pivotal time for pro sports.
Yeah, it really was. And then so much coalesced from 46 to, as you mentioned, you know, Branch Rickey in 47, getting Jackie Robinson. Years before, Bill Veeck tried to buy the Philadelphia Phillies, I believe, and his one intent, among others, was to integrate baseball, but that never happened. Something happened to not allow him to take ownership of that team. So the timeline was the timeline as far as Jackie Robinson is concerned. But Marion Motley, such an amazing figure in sports history here in Northeast Ohio and all around pro football. Do you, obviously, with the Pro Football Hall of Fame where it is he getting his due run in your estimation, David?
You know, I don't think he is, but it's I really don't think that there's a deliberate sense of let's not, you know, it's just that era that a lot of that era that those guys played in, you know, it's, you know, you think about how many generations are past that now.
Yeah.
You know, you know, a lot of folks like my dad, for instance, my dad went to Warren G. Harding. He grew up with Paul Warfield. Paul Warfield wrote the foreword because him and my dad are friends. Those are the guys that really remember that era of football, those guys. But I think now this generation, they just don't really understand how important those guys were to where we are now and how it kind of moved that along and opened the door for so many of those guys. Because here in Canton, like I said, outside of the bust in Canton. But you know what's interesting, JT, is a lot of people, when they find out that I wrote this book about Marion Motley, or they say they've heard it or they've seen it or they've read it, it's always that I've kind of heard of him. Oh, I know he did something, you know. Oh, I've seen his name in the ring up there with like Otto Graham and Bill Willis and Paul Warfield and, you know, at First Energy Stadium. They know that, but they don't really know the story. And once they understand it, or once they read it, or once they're interested in it, and then they read it, I have people email me and say, this was a wonderful story. And I had no idea of the importance of Marion Motley. And I think that's what it is. I think the generations, they're really not understanding it. And the generations that maybe, you know, were around his generation a little bit past, they kind of knew about him. And once they read it, they have a newfound respect. And they feel connected to him more so now because they know of his story and what it take for him to get where he was in an era that really was a brutal time to play for those black players.
Well, in the era that the AAFC years, they were just so dominant. You can understand why that league would kind of, you know, be broken up, right? Because it was, you just couldn't beat them. It was like there was nothing that could handle the Cleveland Browns and the innovations of Paul Brown
and
stuff.
And doing the research, I'm a huge Browns fan because of my dad, like I said, but you know, I didn't know that era. I didn't know that era that well, you know what I mean? Yeah. I mean, I'm 58, I was born in 65. So I wasn't really sure, but doing research and reading what we had and realizing how dominant they were from 46 to 50, I mean, 49, and then going into the NFL from 50 to 59.
Yeah.
I mean, they dominated. I mean, or, you know, they either won the championship or they were playing for a championship. And it was just amazing to realize how dominant they were. And it was because of Paul Brown. I learned so much about, like for instance, I don't know if people know, you've heard of the practice squad or the taxi squad.
Yeah.
Yep. A lot of people don't know how that came about. And the taxi squad came about when the Browns' new owner, Mickey McBride, he owned a taxi company in Akron and Canton. And so when a lot of these players were coming back from the war, a lot of the other NFL players thought that they were going to sign with those players. But the Browns kind of undercut them and signed a lot of those players. So if a lot of those players didn't make the final roster, Mickey McBride would keep them on his payroll as taxi drivers until somebody got hurt or something. And then they would take them off the taxi squad and put them on the roster. And so a lot of people don't know that. And I didn't know that story. I had no idea, you know. But also Paul Brown, you know, he invented the playbook. He invented, you know, headsets and scouting team. And he invented
messenger guards. Remember messenger guards, right?
Yes, absolutely. And I didn't know this either. The 40-yard dash. The 40-yard dash was invented by Paul Brown to measure, because this is what he figured out. He figured out that the average punt traveled 40 yards. So he would measure how fast his players could run in 40-yard distances, because that's how fast they would have to cover. That's the distance they would go to cover an average punt. And that became the measure of speed for, you know, NFL combine, you know, the 40-yard dash. So it's just all of those things that Paul Brown was just, he was just so innovative that it helped them dominate.
Well, you know, it was really cool this past year when the Browns went to those white uniforms, white helmets. All I could think of was the old footage, David, of Mary Motley just busting people's heads. In the open field, that old grainy black and white film that you see that big lumbering. I don't know if it's lumbering. Maybe the film made him appear to be lumbering, but he was a big physical player just knocking people around. And I thought it was great that they did that, because it took me back to those days. But not as many people have that visual sign in their heads the way I do, or maybe people of a generation even older than myself, like my dad. I mean, that was right in my father's wheelhouse. He was like those guys. He was at the Great Lakes Training Center himself. He served in the war. He came back and saw the fellers, you know, and he came back and saw the Cleveland Browns playing at that big old stadium on the lakefront. And that's kind of cool that you can have those remembrances, recollections of what it was like when one of the greatest players to ever play the game was playing for the Cleveland Browns. And he was not alone. There were other Hall of Famers sprinkled through that.
Dante, you know, Dante, Otto Graham, I mean, Lou Dotto. But it's funny you say that, because, like, the book has only been out 7 months, really. I mean, it was released in August, late August. So it's only been out 7 months. But I will tell you this. I've had a blast speaking at libraries across Northeast Ohio. And I'm telling you, JT, I go from Bay Village to Berea to Parma to, I mean, all across, and then, you know, south of Cuyahoga County. And what's been really fun is having older guys and older white guys, you know, 60s, 70s, you know, mid 70s, who want to hear Mary Motley's story because they remember watching him, and they remember just how great of a player he was. And it's been fun to just sit, you know, in Bedford, and you name it, you know, libraries all across, and just have people come in with this communal feeling of, hey, we want to know more about Mary Motley's story because we love the Browns. And even some that really don't follow the Browns as closely as others do, they still want to hear the story because they've heard of Mary Motley. And then I sprinkle in some of the clips from our documentary, and it's been a fun experience to kind of meet up with people who really appreciate who Mary Motley was and where he came from. And that's been really fun, especially being a diehard Browns fan.
Yeah. And when he retired, we all know that he did spend some time with the Steelers. He was out of the game, I believe, for a year. He had a bad knee situation and what have you. But when his career was over, he wanted to get into coaching, and it didn't seem like he was given much of a fair shake in that regard. Explain that to our listeners.
Yeah, you know what? There's a chapter in the book, and it's entitled Mary Motley versus Art Modell. And it's a very interesting chapter because, you know, even you're exactly right. All he wanted to do was coach. But he wanted to scout. He wanted to do anything he could. But Art Modell wouldn't give him a chance. Wouldn't give him a chance. I mean, when he stopped playing and Dante Lavelli stopped playing, Dante Lavelli was scouting, and he said he would call Dante. It's like, Dante, did you get an assignment? And Dante Lavelli would be like, Yeah, I got an assignment. You didn't get called yet? He's like, no. And so that whole chapter is about how Mary Motley, and he was a humble guy. He did not want anything handed to him. He wanted to work hard because that was just how he was brought up. And that was his lifestyle. That's the only thing he knew, to work hard. So he kind of like, not confronted, but he had a conversation with Modell on the field at training camp one day. And it got very heated from how Mary Motley explained it from Modell's standpoint. Mary Motley said, basically, you're a racist because, you know, you're giving all these other guys opportunities. You're not giving me an opportunity. And he said Modell's face got beet red. And he said he just walked away. And he wrote a letter that was published in a black newspaper in Pittsburgh. That was really, really it got printed nationwide through UPI and AP. But he just explained that I didn't do anything. I don't know why they're not giving me a chance, and it has to be because of my color. And he never got a chance to coach. He coached a semi-pro women's team in Cleveland for 1 year. I think it was in 1968, but that league ended. And then he just faded into obscurity. He never coached, never got that opportunity. And as Dave Robinson and we interviewed Mel Blount and a lot of other guys who said he would have been a great ambassador for the game and a great ambassador for black players and a great kind of mentor as some of these guys were coming up. But he was just never given that opportunity, which was sad.
Yeah, it really seemed to be all indications were that he felt he had something to offer and just wanted to get his foot in the door. And again, I think we're talking about some racist attitudes back in the day and difficult to overcome those. And speaking of that, let's go back into the days that he was on the Browns and he and Bill Willis encountered instances. How difficult were some of those that you may have be pointing out in the book?
Yeah, you know what? Mary Motley, we had great audio tapes. We had about maybe 10 hours of audio tape of him, which was kind of really amazing to listen to him, to actually listen to him. It sounds like he's in a hotel. It might have been when he was being inducted into the Hall of Fame. I think it might have been maybe around then, but he's in a hotel room with a reporter, you could tell. And he talks candidly about how him and Bill Willis, they tried to, as much as they could, try to separate everything that was going on in the country as far as racism and Jim Crow, because they felt like they were insulated when they were with the Browns and with their teammates and with Paul Brown. Because Paul Brown, there's an instance where they were playing the Miami Seahawks. They all check in, and the guy who was there was checking them in said, you know, we've got all your rooms set up and we've got them set up somewhere else. And Paul Brown said, okay, I totally understand that, but just understand this. They stay here. We all stay here or we're all leaving. And the guy said, oh, well, I think we could set them up somewhere. So that was Paul Brown's whole mentality. So that helped those guys. Now on the field, it was a completely different story because you had opponents biting them, punching them, kicking them, spitting on them, calling them the N-word, all of that. You know, everything that you would kind of think that a black man or a black person in the United States would have to encounter during that time period, you were encountering that on the field and being chased by those same guys, you know, for the whole game. But it's interesting because they understood that if they did anything, if they retaliated, it might have affected any of the other players coming along next year, the year after that, year after that. So you have to think about the type of patience they had and kind of resolve they had not to not to retaliate. Now, Bill Willis was different because he was playing defense. So he, you know, he had the ability to say, and he did, you know, Marion would say on several occasions that they'd come off the field and Bill said, don't worry about that. I got you. Along with a lot of his white teammates. They had his back from training camp because Paul Brown made it clear, if you don't accept these guys, you're not going to be on this team. That was established from day one. So you didn't have to worry about him not being supported. And that was a great thing about that team and those Paul Brown teams. They were going to be a team, and they were going to protect those guys.
Well, it is the ultimate team game, the game of football. And so to bring all these different individuals together with one motive in mind and to be the best in that league, the AAFC, and then obviously in those early years of the NFL when the Browns came in 50 and won the NFL title as quote-unquote rookies, they had tremendous psychological makeup all up and down that roster. And much as I'm sure Branch Rickey kind of vetted Jackie Robinson on a psychological level, because what a burden to bear, I'm sure Paul Brown had in some way, shape, or form the same kind of psychological vetting going on in his mind or whatever towards these two individuals, because he was going to place them in harm's way everywhere they went as a team.
Right. I think maybe, you know, I'm speculating, but I'm just guessing this, you know, being a Warren, Northeast Ohio, understanding Maslin in this area, you know, I would have just imagined that Paul Brown being from Maslin and coaching at Maslin and coaching black players and coaching and not caring about a person's color of their skin, as long as they could play the game and they have character and all of that. Yeah. I think that played a big role in who Paul Brown was going to pick on his team and the fact that race and color was not going to matter, because he, you know, being from here, he knew that wasn't going to be a criteria. And so I think that may have had a lot to do with it. I mean, if you look at like Horace Gillum, I mean, he was a Maslin guy, played for Paul Brown and ended up being a punter and playing for Paul Brown with the Browns. So yeah, I think Paul Brown had a lot to do with that, because it didn't matter. If you could play the game and you did things the right way, you were going to play.
Yeah, well, fascinating. The whole story about Marion Motley and what you've done with the printed word and the research that went into it. Yeoman's work and huge kudos to you. And it's doing well from what all indications are. What sense are you getting in that regard?
Yeah, it's doing well. I mean, on Amazon, it's you know, it's got great reviews. But you know what's interesting, JT, is just the other day I got an email from my publisher that said that the book was named a 2023 finalist for the Forward magazine, which is a very prestigious magazine in the indie. It's the Forward Indie Book Award. It's a finalist. And basically the Forward magazine and the Forward Indies, it's basically celebrates titles from independent publishers. You know, not your Random House or Penguin House, you know, Penguin, independent, you know, University of Georgia Press, University of Akron Press, University of Notre Dame Press, because I saw a lot of books that I went up against were from the University of Georgia Press. And other independent booksellers that sell books, but not at that level of Random House, you know.
Yeah.
So when I saw that, I thought, wow, that was just a wonderful, wonderful honor that I didn't even know about until I got the email. And it's funny, it's so I looked at some of the other, so I'm in the category of adult nonfiction biography. And some of the other books that I'm going up against are a biography of Tina Turner, a biography of Richard Nixon written by his daughter, Trisha Nixon.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. So, I mean, but that's, I'm like, are you kidding me? That's, Mary Motley is up with these people. That's great. I'm a finalist, and that's awesome. There's only, there's 8 books for that out of, I think I want to say out of 2,400 books. I think maybe even more than that. But it's a huge, huge pool that was whittled down to now the finals. So I'll know June 16th at at noon.
Oh, that's first of all, congratulations on that.
Thanks,
I think
JT.
That's amazing. That is really amazing. And well, you know how to pick the stories in which to, you know, write stories about. I mean, a year ago, I had you on this same podcast talking about your early days with LeBron.
Yeah.
And how you were writing about LeBron and his buddies when they were in the sixth grade. You were ahead of everybody's curve. And then now, you know, you do this project on one of the truly great NFL Hall of Famers, part of the, you know, 100 years greatest players collection, Marion Motley, statues made of him and all that stuff. And it's not just that this guy had a statue made and he's in a Hall of Fame, but he's a compelling story. And you tell a compelling story. That's what good journalists do.
You just took that. That's exactly, I was waiting for you to finish because I was going to say that. And you said exactly what I was about to say. So I was at school. I teach at Stowe Monroe Falls High School. So I was at, I was at school, and it was yesterday. And I walk in, and the basketball coach, Dave Close, a legend high school coach. He said, "Hey, Dave," he follows my career. I mean, we've worked together when I was at the Beacon and covered him, and he was great. He said, "Hey, man, how do you do it?" You know, and he was giving me all this praise, and it was almost nothing against him, but it was almost embarrassing because the thing is, I'm not a great writer. I mean, and understand what I'm saying. I'm not looking for it. Like, I enjoy what I do. I love what I do. But it's because of my journalistic background. I mean, I've covered stories. I've covered people. I've written about people for so long that if they have a good story, your journalistic background will help you be able to tell that story.
Yeah, it out.
Yeah, I mean, that's what it is. Marion Motley, it was a great story. Nobody really told it. And so it was just using your who, what, when, where, and why, interviewing this person, interviewing somebody else, and then unlayering somebody else that you, and then finding out this story and said, "Oh, I got to go chase this because they told me about this. Hey, do you know this? They said this." Oh, yeah. It was just, it's just being a journalist and then doing all your research and doing all your interviews. And then now figuring out, how do I put this story together? How is it going to flow? Is it going to be chronologically? Are we going to start out with a bang and then go chronologically? Are we going to do vignettes? Are we going to do a little short story? Like, that's how, you know, that's the kind of the hard part, putting it together, because you have so much information. Now, how do you put it together? But really, it's just finding these stories that are out there. And for everybody who writes, there are stories everywhere, every single day. You could go to Giant Eagle. You could go anywhere. Talk to somebody for 5 minutes. You'll find a story. You can find a story.
Well, and you did. And the cool thing is that you decide to write about an individual who's such a compelling figure and a fascinating story in Marion Motley after his, you know, after his moment in the sun with the AAFC, Cleveland Browns, and then the Browns in the NFL. But you wrote the story on LeBron before LeBron, you know, even set foot on an NBA floor. I mean, you saw that. And so, you know, I think it takes a special talent to know what's a compelling story, not just a kid that jumps high and can dunk a basketball. There's so much more to many layers to LeBron, as we've come to see. Well, how do you feel about him? You know, 40,000 points. Obviously, he passed Kareem a year or so ago.
Yeah.
And he's still playing. He's approaching 40 years of age. This is insane.
Yeah, it's crazy. It just seemed like it was yesterday that it was 2003. And and the book had come out a week before his first game at Sacramento. It was a 10 o'clock game, and I was nervous. My hands were sweating. And he comes out, and he's hitting baseline jumpers. And he almost – records a triple double. I think he had like 25, 9, and 8 or something like that. I even said this on record, Wade. You know, I knew he was going to be a great NBA player. I didn't know if he was going to be the greatest, but because he had already played against NBA people when he was a junior, you know, when he wasn't supposed to, but he was playing. And to hear Maverick Carter and other people say, "Man, you should have saw him. He was one of the, out of the 10 on the court, he was number 6 or number, you know." So you knew then, and just watching him and his basketball IQ, the way he passed, the way he could see the court, and then physically, he just had everything. So you just knew that as long as he stayed healthy, he was going to be amazing player, a great player. I didn't know he would be Like, I didn't think there's no way I thought he would be the all-time leading scorer and be the only NBA player in history to record 40,000 points. Never did I think that, but I knew he'd be a great player and an all-star.
Yeah, it's really been so fascinating to watch his career, especially being there somewhat in the early days, not as early as you per se, David, but it was so fascinating to just follow him along as time has gone on. Well, you picked a great a topic in LeBron for that early book, and then obviously this book on Marion Motley. Are you going to continue along this path, continue to, you know, teach the kids down at Stowe High School, learn about journalism and what is a good story, that type of thing, and then just kind of let projects kind of come to you that kind of hit you, strike you with the right vibe before you go and write another book?
Yeah, that's what it is. I mean, I love teaching. I never thought I'd get into teaching, but, you know, as a sports writer, you know, during the day we're off, not us. You were on TV all the time. You were at the station, but I would go speak to schools. My friends were teachers. And then the more I did that, the more I realized that, you know, I was making an impact on these kids and teaching them how to write and how important the English language is and writing, how important that is. So yeah, the thing is with projects that come, you know, I don't look out because I'm not really covering things like I used to. So I'm not really, I'm not connected to certain things like I'm covering beats, but I do have another book project that's going to come out this August. It's already on Amazon. You can order them. So my publisher of the Marion Motley book, as I was writing that book, this had to be, I think it was in 2021. They asked me, they said, "Hey, would you be interested in doing a children's book series called Black Trailblazers in Sports?" Sweet. And I said, "Yeah, you know, what do you have? And what are you thinking?" So they said, "Well, we'll get to you once we kind of get with this Marion Motley book and this is done." So then when we were done with that, they said, "Okay, here's the idea. So we want to do a Black Trailblazers in Sports for grades 4 through 7. So it's ages 8 through 13. And so the books are, I'm doing them in order. So it was Jesse Owens, Jackie Robinson, Wilma Rudolph, Venus and Serena, Arthur Ashe, Bill Russell, Cheryl Owens, and who's the last one? Doug Williams. So there's an 8 book series. If you go to Amazon right now, type in Black Trailblazers in Sports, it's 8 book series. You could order the whole series, or you could order the book separately. I've already got speaking engagements at different schools and libraries this summer and into fall. But it's very important to let kids understand black, white, doesn't matter their background, just the pioneers and the trailblazers, the black trailblazers and pioneers of sports, and how these people kind of open the doors for others. Marion Motley is considered a trailblazer as well. Sure. But we put these together. But what was interesting about this, JT, is, you know, I knew about all of these, but when you research it for a children's book, you're relearning about these people. And then it's interesting because the common thread that they all seem to have was that they were very conscious of what was going on in society and in life. And they were all about equality, and to the point where they didn't care if their careers ended or if they were seen as people who were troublemakers. They knew what they were doing at the time was right.
Yeah.
And that was the interesting thread, that every one of those people that I named had that thread of, hey, you know, we are, you know, we should be treated fairly and we should be given opportunities just like white people are given opportunities. And it's almost like that thread all the way through. Cheryl Miller, you name them, Venus and Serena opened the door for, you know, Coco, you know, opened the door for Naomi. I mean, you name it. And so that was fun to do, to learn a little bit more about how important they were, not in their field playing, but when they stepped off the field.
So is the book of short stories on each person of these 8, or are there 8 books? How's
they're
that work?
They're 8 books, and they're 4 chapters, 4 chapters in each. They're 32 pages each. I say for middle school. So, you know, it's a middle school level. But it's not like a children's book. It's middle school. And very, very informative. And at the end, there's like a little quiz. There's like charts to show where they played or where they lived or where they grew up. There's an index and a glossary. So it's perfect for the middle school age group and for them to learn about these Black trailblazers. Like I say, school districts, libraries, they could either buy the book as a set or they could buy the books individually. And each book is 32 pages.
Well, you do great work, and the word gets out, and you're always going to be busy. There's always going to be projects because you do great stuff. And always,
thanks, JT.
Always a pleasure, David, to not just chat with you, but to keep abreast of how things are going for you. We go back a long, long way.
Absolutely.
And looks like this book is doing very well. All good luck to you on this the voting, if you will, on this award that you
are
up for. So much respect for you, my friend.
Appreciate
and I look
it.
Forward to I look forward to the next time that we could chat. But as we close things out, once again, give all the info that you want folks to know about the book on Mary and Motley.
Yeah, Mary and Motley, you could go to Amazon.com and order at Barnes and Noble. You can go to North Star Editions. That's my publisher. They're out of Minneapolis, and they're a great independent publisher. But I do want to say this. If there's any organization or group that wants me to come out and just, you know, give a presentation on who Mary Motley was, I love meeting people. I love coming out and talking to people about the Browns. So if they're interested, you could just go to my website. It's davidleemorganjr.com. It's my name.com. And there's a place where you could contact me. But like I said, I love coming out and sharing this story. It's a great story that finally has been told and it's out. And once I get out with people and they start reading it or they hear about it, it makes them feel really good and connected. So I appreciate you having me on and giving me this platform to talk about it because it's a great story.
It really is a great story. You do an outstanding job and much success to you, my friend. I look forward to chatting with you the next time around, David.
Thanks, JT. Take care, brother.
Thanks so much to David Lee Morgan for chatting with us on this week's edition of Telage Talks. And as always, if you can help us here with the algorithms, as it were, rate, review, follow the pod. We are on all the podcast platforms that you can find. And thanks very much for listening. As always, we look forward to our next chat next week on another edition of Telage Talks.